Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1166. Bio-Psyop Apocalypse Now, Part 22. A Pound of Cure, Part 1. This is being recorded on November 28th of the year 2020. As indicated by our encyclopedically numbered episodes of Bio-Psyop Apocalypse Now, we are going to be continuing with our discussion of aspects of the COVID-19 operation, and it is almost certainly an operation. In For the Record programs 1156 through 1160, we looked at a series of programs we called An Ounce of Prevention. And what we were looking at concerns, at a superficial level, the old adage that, quote, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Cueing with the official title of the deadly Unit 731 Japanese Biological Warfare Program, the results and files of which were incorporated into the U.S. Biological Warfare Program at the end of World War II. That unit was titled the Guandong, or the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Unit of the Guandong Army. Whereas it was not in the business of preventing epidemics, it was in the business of producing epidemics. And what we're now looking at concerns the pound of cure. In the first part of our series, we looked at a number of overlapping programs, including programs that were inextricably linked with the USAID-funded program with, I call it the Oswald Institute of Virology, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which was partnered with the EcoHealth Alliance and financed by USAID, a common CIA front, and in turn was partnered with, again, the EcoHealth Alliance, and as part of that program, they were genetically altering bat-borne coronaviruses, and the behavior of same is altogether suspicious. When one has studied the JFK assassination, it is a really useful paradigm for understanding what has taken place since. For example, the Russiagate nonsense, blaming, quote, hacks, unquote, on, quote, Russian intelligence and so forth, is very much like the painting of Oswald Ridd. And then For the Record programs 925 and 926, I took a look at that, or we took a look at that. And by the same token, the framing, because I believe that is what it was, the setting up of the Wuhan Institute of Virology to take the fall for the beginning of this pandemic is very much like the painting of Oswald Ridd or the framing of Lee Harvey Oswald to look like a, quote, communist, unquote, before he was framed for JFK's assassination and then dispatched before he could have a trial. The USAID, by the way, was one of the companies that, one of the institutions, I should say, that was a cover for William Herman. Herman was a fellow, Edward Herman, a mega intelligence officer, almost certainly working for CIA and definitely working for a number of other overlapping institutions, including DARPA, the aforementioned U.S. Agency for International Development. He was working with LAPD, many defense contractors, and perhaps most importantly, was involved with the Phoenix program in South Vietnam, what was then South Vietnam, and in all probability, some aspects of a domestic Phoenix program as well. In addition to USAID, Herman also worked for DARPA, and DARPA has been heavily involved in not only the financing of research into bat-borne coronaviruses, including and especially in and around China, but it, in turn, DARPA has been involved with the financing of, among other companies, Moderna. They have an mRNA vaccine that has been touted as effective in connection with COVID-19, as we will see. Both the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer/BioNTech vaccine had essentially been promoted via press releases and not through peer-reviewed scientific and professional journals. That is but the tip of the iceberg, in addition to what we're going to look at in our next program. Not just DARPA, which is heavily involved with Moderna, but the military in general is at the very epicenter of COVID-19 treatment in the U.S., vaccine distribution and regulation in particular. I was talking about Moderna. Moncef Slaoui, who was in charge of product development for Moderna, is now the basically heading up Operation Warp Speed. He is working with a four-star general named Gustav Perna, who is involved with coordinating the logistical operations of Operation Warp Speed. And as we will see, the military basically is centrally involved and appears to perhaps be the most centrally involved institution with regard to the vaccines that are now being eagerly anticipated. We'll talk more about this. But as we look at a pound of cure, having looked at an ounce of prevention, we are going to take a look at institutions from the military to DARPA to things that appear to cover for CIA, such as USAID, and also aspects of the IG Farben/Bormann milieu in connection with the German BioNTech startup. I mean, really, it is more than just a startup, but a biotech company that is partnered with Pfizer and has produced a vaccine that has been very highly touted. As we will see, the Turkish couple who are the public face of BioNTech got their money to do their operations from some sources that look very much like part of the remarkable and deadly Mormon capital organization, the element that I believe will prove to be the decisive factor in human affairs on this planet. What we're going to do in this program is to begin by taking a look at a drug called remdesivir. This is an antiviral originally developed to combat Ebola. As we will see, it is not only Gilead Sciences, but the military itself, which helped to develop remdesivir. We've looked at remdesivir at great length in past programs. Interestingly, in March of last year, 2019, there was a program that was begun at the U.S. Army's Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRIID, that involved the testing of remdesivir on Ebola-infected rhesus macaque monkeys. Fort Detrick was closed, the USAMRIID at Fort Detrick was closed down in early August of 2019 for unspecified safety violations. The little bit that we have been able to see about those unspecified safety violations is intriguing, but again, the curtain of national security has been drawn around that, and I think it is a safe bet that we will never know exactly what was going on. However, the waste from unnamed non-human primates was being disposed in an improper fashion, and those primates had been infected with what was called a select agent, unquote. We don't know if that was Ebola in the aforementioned rhesus macaque monkey remdesivir study, or whether it might perhaps have been SARS-CoV-2 or a similar virus. We also noted that the USAMRIIB used private contractors for their work, meaning just about anybody could have been in there, could have been CIA, could have been veterans of Project Coast, who knows, so that it basically would be Katie barred the door. We are going to take a look at an op-ed column from the New York Times of November 18th of 2020 by Ravi, R-A-V-I, Gupta, G-U-P-T-A, and Reshma, R-E-S-H-M-A, Ramachandran, R-A-M-A-C-H-A-N-D-R-A-N. And they are, Ravi Gupta is an internal medicine physician and fellow at the National Clinician Scholars Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Ramachandran is a family medicine physician and a fellow at the National Clinician Scholars Program at Yale University. They are both members of Doctors for America Drug Affordability Action Team. And they have a column called Does Remdesivir Work? And it raises some of the regulatory and operational considerations vis-a-vis Remdesivir, which has been not only fast-tracked, but apparently fast-tracked in contradiction of some of the results about how effective it really is. A movable thing, we took a look at this in, for the record, 1152 and 1153. An excerpt from this op-ed column. Remdesivir predates the pandemic. It was first considered as a potential treatment for Ebola and was developed through a long-standing partnership between the U.S. Army and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So the military was involved with the development of Remdesivir. Indeed, Gilead Sciences, the maker of Remdesivir, now being marketed as Veklury. I may be mispronouncing that. That's capital V-E-K-L-U-R-Y. Gilead Sciences has some very, it's a very well-connected biotech company. And indeed, the chairman of the board for many years was none other than Donald Rumsfeld, who left his position as chairman of the board at Gilead Sciences to become George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. He later helped authorize a very lucrative purchase of oseltamivir, marketed as Tamiflu, to combat an H5N1 flu epidemic which never actually materialized. Nonetheless, Gilead Sciences made a whole lot of money from those federal contracts, and so did Donald Rumsfeld, who had not sold his stock in Gilead Sciences. That is something of a paradigm. At some point in the not-too-distant future, we will take a look at how much money or the making of money by Gilead Sciences over HIV treatments and the fact that the company was started up in part by C as in Charlie, Benno, B-E-N-N-O, Schmidt, who was a major factor in pushing Richard Nixon to create his, quote, war on cancer, unquote, which served, among other things, as a cover for the programs that appear to have been for the development of AIDS as a BW weapon under the cover of researching viral-caused cancers. We're going to take a look at the role, again, of the military in developing Remdesivir, now Veklury, and also the erosion of regulatory standards for Remdesivir. And for not just Remdesivir, but for drugs in general, we are going to review briefly how Remdesivir was flogged by, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19, some of those scientists being Peter Thiel and junk bond king Michael Milken, how they network with people like Tommy Hicks Jr., who in turn is an investment partner with J. Kyle Bass, an associate of Steve Bannon and the anti-China epicenter that we have looked at so many times in the past, and that really has to be seen in the COVID-19 really has to be seen in the context of the full court press against China. So now let's begin with this column. Does Remdesivir work? By Ravi Gupta and Reshma Ramachandran from the New York Times of November 18th of 2020. When the Food and Drug Administration approves a new treatment or vaccine, as doctors, we are assured that rigorous studies have proven it to be safe and effective. But the FDA's haphazard issuance of emergency use authorizations for COVID-19 treatments like hydroxychloroquine and convalescent plasma, whose potential benefits have not yet been backed up by data, has undermined this trust. Early in the pandemic, the agency awarded an emergency use authorization for the antiviral drug Remdesivir based on evidence suggesting that it may be effective. Then, last month, despite conflicting evidence, the FDA prematurely granted its first full approval for COVID-19 treatment to Remdesivir, now marketed as Veklury. One more time. Then, last month, despite conflicting evidence, the FDA prematurely granted its full approval for COVID-19 treatment to Remdesivir, now marketed as Veklury. In early October, the New England Journal of Medicine published a report on the results of a trial funded by the National Institutes of Health that found that Remdesivir decreased recovery time in COVID-19 patients who were hospitalized with less severe illness, but did not curb mortality at all. Other studies have shown no benefit, including the World Health Organization's Solidarity Trial, released as a preprint on October 15th. Based on these results, the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine is now recommending that Remdesivir not be routinely used in hospitalized COVID-19 patients. One more time. Based on these results, and noting that the World Health Organization's Solidarity Trial found no benefit for Remdesivir, based on these results, the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine is now recommending that the drug not be routinely used in hospitalized COVID-19 patients. Infectious disease experts have stated that after examining all available evidence, we can reasonably conclude only that Remdesivir may work. Some have argued that the approval of the Veklury is justified even if it is only mildly effective because there are no other proven therapies for COVID-19. This fails to acknowledge, however, the proven effectiveness of drugs like dexamethasone, a cheap and widely used steroid. I would also note in the very first show I did about the pandemic, for the record 1111, I mentioned that a readily available cocktail of antiviral drugs had proved very effective in treating very severely ill patients in Thailand. We haven't heard any real follow-up on that, have we? I don't know what follow-up has been done or how effective it turned out to be, but the initial results were very promising indeed. And given the amount of hype and the tremendous amount of capital and political and military institutions behind the development of Remdesivir, now the Veklury, I think the primacy, the ascent of the Veklury in the COVID-19 pantheon is something we should look very askance at. Continuing. It, meaning the approval of Remdesivir, it also ignores years of assault on FDA evidentiary standards accelerated by the passage in 2016 of the 21st Century Cures Act. One more time. It also ignores years of assault on FDA evidentiary standards accelerated by the passage in 2016 of the 21st Century Cures Act. This legislation, which sped up the FDA's approval process, was based on unfounded claims that the agency was too slow and hindered patients' access to life-saving drugs. As a result, the FDA is now increasingly approving new drugs based on weaker evidence, relying on surrogate measures, unquote, like changes in tumor size, in lieu of more meaningful clinical outcomes such as reduced mortality or hospitalizations. Recent cancer drugs, for example, have been approved without evidence of improving overall survival. Weaker standards are a boon to pharmaceutical companies, but they can also depress the development of truly innovative and effective treatments. The FDA has tried to offset its accelerated approval of Veklury by asking its maker, Gilead Sciences, to complete 29 post-market studies to further examine the drug's effectiveness and safety. This is more than 3 to 4 times the number typically requested. It's unclear, however, if these studies will ever be done. One report found that 5 to 6 years following approval, only half of post-market studies have been completed, and one-fifth hadn't even been started. Veklury's approval could also have a chilling effect on the FDA's ability to issue emergency use authorizations for other potentially effective COVID-19 treatments, as the agency's guidance requires that there be, quote, no adequate, approved, and available alternative, unquote, for the disease. Just last week, the FDA granted an authorization to an antibody treatment called bamlanivimab, that's B-A-M-L-A-N-I-V-I-M-A-B, for use in non-hospitalized patients with COVID-19 who are at the highest risk of developing severe disease. This may have been possible only because Veklury was approved specifically for hospitalized patients. Veklury's questionable effectiveness is even more problematic given the drug's price. A course costs $3,120, a huge price tag, and one that ignores the substantial public investment in the drug's development. Remdesivir predates this pandemic. It was first considered as a potential treatment for Ebola, it fizzled badly by the way, and was developed through a long-standing partnership between the U.S. Army and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It was repurposed for COVID-19 after multi-million dollar trials sponsored by the NIH suggested it could work against coronaviruses. Despite Veklury's questionable effectiveness, the FDA has also awarded Gilead, quote, a priority review voucher, unquote, worth $75 to $100 million. This voucher can be used by Gilead or sold to a different manufacturer to hasten review of another drug application. This would perpetuate the entry of other treatments that are hurriedly reviewed and, like remdesivir, may be of uncertain benefit. The dangers posed by the FDA's rush in approving the Veklury are compounded by the chaos of presumed political interference by the Trump administration. But the weakening of FDA standards will most likely continue under the Biden administration. When he was vice president, Joe Biden strongly endorsed the 21st Century Cures Act, and some in Congress are already pushing for its next iteration, Cures 2.0. If passed, it would further erode the FDA's evidentiary standards. Among Cures 2.0 proposals is moving the basis for approval away from randomized controlled trials, long considered the gold standard of evidence, and instead relying more on observational evidence and surrogate measures. It's hard to ask people to wait for the evidence when there's a treatment that could hold some promise, especially during a devastating pandemic. But the hasty approval of expensive new treatments like remdesivir is not the solution. Doctors like us must feel confident that the drugs approved by the FDA are worth prescribing to our patients. Well, again, the history of remdesivir, now being marketed as Veklury, is one that is inextricably linked with the national security establishment. We've talked about remdesivir. And for the record, 1132, 1134, and 1138, among other programs. And one of the things to bear in mind, aside from the fact that it has a joint CDC and military developmental history, is that remdesivir has been the beneficiary not only of tremendous massaging by the regulatory institutions that are supposed to be impartial and rigorous, but in turn, the lax federal standards and the evident crony capitalism involved in the development of remdesivir have facilitated the approval of a drug which, again, may work. There is a link in the description for what I'm going to talk about. We have talked about the hasty procedure through which the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases has approved remdesivir, and a StatNews article had some very good excerpts that will be in the description for this program. But one of the big changes was the DSMB, or the Data and Safety Monitoring Board, regulatory procedure. And in that StatNews article we read, the job of reviewing these analyses would fall to a committee of outside experts on what is known as an Independent Data and Safety Monitoring Board, or DSMB. But the DSMB for the remdesivir study did not ever meet for an interim efficacy analysis. One more time. But the DSMB for the remdesivir study did not ever meet for an interim efficacy analysis. All patients had been enrolled by April 20th. That's April 20th of this year. The data for a DSMB meeting was cut off on April 22nd, 2 days later. The DSMB met, and on April 27th, it made a recommendation to the NIAB. That led to a very positive press release by Gilead Sciences and the NIAID that both drove up still further the stock price of Gilead Sciences. It also, because of the optimism about an impending cures, it helped drive the market as a whole. In this context, inside trading would be something of an Olympic event, I think, if one could take a good look at what was going on with remdesivir. But do note, as going back to that StatNews article, that decision led the NIAID to conclude that patients who had been given placebo should be offered remdesivir, something that started happening after April 28th. On April 29th, the press release drove up the stock market, drove up the price of Gilead Sciences stock, and on April 29th, that same day, a guy named Joe Grogan, G-R-O-G-A-N, who was part of President Trump's COVID-19 task force, resigned his position in the Trump administration. Again, he was part of the COVID-19 task force. Before joining the Trump administration, Joe Grogan was a lobbyist for Gilead Sciences, the maker of remdesivir. We have also taken a look at the, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19, a bunch of billionaires with links to Tommy Hicks Jr., who has been at the epicenter of interagency government networks involved with various aspects of the anti-China effort. He also is an investment partner with J. Kyle Bass, someone that we will be talking about more when we get into the wealth concentration virus, which is another major aspect of our analysis. Note some of the things that scientists to stop COVID-19 have been doing. And again, some of those scientists, people like Peter Thiel, people like J. Michael Milken, and people networked with people like Tommy Hicks Jr. and other high rollers and members of the Trump administration. So about remdesivir, now the chloride. Scientists to stop COVID-19 recommends that in this phase, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, should work to coordinate with Gilead Pharmaceuticals to focus on expediting the results of clinical trials of remdesivir, a drug identified as a potential treatment for COVID-19. The group also recommends administering doses of the drug to patients in an early stage of infection and notes remdesivir will essentially be a placeholder until a more effective treatment is produced. In that New York Times column, the authors, both Mr. Gupta and Mr. Ramachandran, know, or Dr. Gupta and Dr. Ramachandran, know that that very approval makes it less likely that other drugs that may prove more effective will get the nod for from officialdom. Now, note more about the process that, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19 have been using. Government entities and agencies appear to adhere to the recommendations outlined by the group, which the Wall Street Journal, with the Wall Street Journal reporting that the FDA and Department of Veterans Affairs have implemented some of the suggestions, namely relaxing drug manufacturer regulations and requirements for potential coronavirus treatment drugs. Note this again. Government entities and agencies appear to adhere to the recommendations outlined by the group, which the Wall, with the Wall Street Journal reporting that the FDA and Department of Veterans Affairs have implemented some of the suggestions, namely relaxing drug manufacturer regulations and requirements for potential coronavirus treatment drugs. And then again, note that on April 29th, that very same day that the expedited and manipulated and massaged remdesivir study was released in a press release, it drove up Gilead Sciences stock, it drove up the market, and Joe Grogan, a member of the White House COVID-19 task force, resigned. Previously, he had been a lobbyist for Gilead Sciences. And we're going to turn next to some very alarming aspects of the vaccines that have been, quote, approved, unquote, really it has, is approval via press release for treating COVID-19. Now, I will restate again, as I have stated many times, I am not an anti-vaxxer per se. I think that vaccines, when properly made and when properly vetted, are absolutely indispensable tools for maintaining public health globally. However, as indicated in the that New York Times column by Drs. Gupta and Ramachandran, the approval process has been, well, shall we say, lubricated, and the regulatory regulations are, as a result, far lax. In addition, the tremendous haste with which vaccines are being developed and the lack of regulatory scrutiny to for of these vaccines is more than a little alarming. Note that it normally takes 4 to 5 years for a vaccine to be approved for administration. The dire circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, and it is a safe bet that at least some of the outbreaks are being deliberately seeded. The speed and devastation of the COVID-19 phenomenon is leading to a I think a very destructive and reckless approval process without anywhere near the sort of peer review and scrutiny that is required. The two vaccines that have been high profile have been a joint Pfizer and BioNTech. That's a German biotech company. We'll have more to say about that in our next program. But the Pfizer / BioNTech vaccine and also the Moderna vaccine are both messenger RNA vaccines. No mRNA vaccine has ever been approved for human use. And experts have noted that very often mRNA vaccines produce serious side effects down the line after the people have been vaccinated, quite a bit of time after they have been vaccinated. What we're going to look at in this program, again, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but I think there are abundant reasons for people to feel very scared about what is going on. I'm going to begin again with something we've used many times. This is a quote from an excerpt from a 1988 book called Gene Wars, Military Control Over the New Technologies, co-authored by Charles Piller and Keith R. Yamamoto, published by William Morrow in 1988. Jonathan King is quoted here. Jonathan King, who has chaired the microbial physiology study section for the National Institutes of Health, believes that without independent intensive scrutiny, the Pentagon is free to obscure its true goals. Quote, the Defense Department appears to be pursuing many narrow applied goals that are by nature of offensive, such as the genetic, quote, improvement, unquote, of BW agents, biological warfare agents, King says. But to achieve political acceptability, they mask these intentions under forms of research such as vaccine development, which sound defensive. Bearing in mind again that the Moderna vaccine was financed in part by the Pentagon, by DARPA. We looked at that in that consummately important Whitney Webb article. And remember that the guy who was in charge of product development for Moderna, Moncef, M-O-N-C-E-F, Slaoui, S-L-A-O-U-I, is basically the top civilian in charge of the Trump administration's Operation Warp Speed. And as we will see, the Pentagon is maybe the dominant element in Operation Warp Speed. In other words, this is a military project. Before we get into that, however, note that the tremendous success that has been touted of these vaccines, and they're going to require refrigeration. The Pfizer BioNTech vaccine requires refrigeration at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. The Moderna vaccine at minus 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Not as extreme, but it raises serious questions about how effectively that those temperatures are going to be maintained, given the enormous scope of the vaccination program. It may well be that General Perna's Army logistics infrastructure will be able to do a good job in that regard. However, something that large is bound to have mistakes, and there are reasons to look askance at this whole thing. First of all, the quote, good news, unquote, that we have been receiving from the New York Times of November 17th of 2020. Another vaccine appears to work against the virus. This is by Denise Gravy, G-R-A-B-Y. And a big long article. Skipping way down into it, we find the following, way, way, way down in this front page article, and that on the inside pages. But the companies, meaning Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, but the companies announced the findings in news releases, not in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and did not disclose the detailed data that would allow outside experts to evaluate their claims. Therefore, the results cannot be considered conclusive. The figures on effectiveness may change as the studies continue. However, so far, it looks like the vaccines are being fast-tracked. One more time, from another vaccine, appears to work against the virus. And this is a long article. Began on the front page, continued at great length on the inside. But just these few sentences here. But the companies announced the findings in news releases, not in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and did not disclose the detailed data that would allow outside experts to evaluate their claims. Therefore, the results cannot be considered conclusive. The figures on effectiveness may change as the studies continue. In other words, basically, this is a shot in the dark, pun intended. And we will talk about the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and the apparent funding of BioNTech in particular in our next program. However, note the following. And this is Moderna's vaccine program, bearing in mind, again, that DARPA is one of the major funders of Moderna, that Moderna in general tends to release their positive news in press releases. They tout the DARPA financing of Moderna in press releases, but not in some of their patent applications. But note the following. This is by Sharon Lafreniere, Katie Thomas, Noah Weiland, David Gellis, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, and Denise Grady of the New York Times of November 22nd of the year 2020. Politics, science, and the remarkable race for a viable vaccine. And note the following. Moderna's vaccine team was headed by a Defense Department official whom company executives described only as, quote, the major, unquote, saying they don't know if his name is supposed to be a secret. Well, who is that? Particularly given that A, Moderna has gotten DARPA funding, B, that Moncef Slaoui, in charge of product development for Moderna, is the key civilian involved with Operation Warp Speed. Who is this guy? Again, Moderna's team was headed by a Defense Department official whom company executives described only as the major, unquote, saying they don't know if his name is supposed to be a secret. Well, I, for one, would like to have that information. And note the rampaging pandemic in the U.S., again from the New York Times of November 19th of 2020. One benefit of surge in cases, a faster evaluation of vaccines. The coronavirus is spreading out of control in the U.S., overwhelming health systems, and killing more than 1,100 Americans a day. But there is a slender silver lining. It is hastening the testing of vaccines that could eventually end the pandemic. The surging virus has already allowed Pfizer and Moderna to accelerate the testing of their vaccines, which appear to be very effective at preventing COVID-19. And if, as seems inevitable, the virus continues to proliferate, it is likely to speed the evaluations of promising vaccine candidates. Well, that certainly is true. One wonders, given the history of this country's national security establishment, not only of testing various BW agents on unwitting American civilian populations, but given the willingness of some of the people that we have partnered with over the better part of 100 years, now dating back to the really the closing days of World War II, when many of the top Nazi scientists and the Unit 731 people were grafted onto our own national security establishment, on up through the Cold War, when our biological warfare establishment hooked up with people from the apartheid regime of South Africa who were unabashed about their willingness to launch a catastrophic biological warfare attack on the U.S. There is no shortage of people who would willingly basically vector parts of America. I'm not saying that all of this, or most of it even, is the result of vectoring, but I'm very suspicious, in particular of the initial outbreak in New York, which seeded, supposedly, the American outbreak. We talked about that in For the Record 1128. But now note the following, and again, the surge in cases is leading to the speeding up of approval, not just for drugs like Veklury, remdesivir, but also for vaccines. And note the following. This by Jennifer Steinhauer, Steinhauer, from the New York Times of November 27th of 2020. The military's role in vaccine will be behind the scenes despite Trump's claims. This has some really special things. When President Trump talks about efforts to deliver the coronavirus vaccine to millions of Americans eager to return to their normal lives, he often says he is, quote, counting on the military, unquote, to get it done. In reality, the role of the military has been less public and more pervasive than this characterization suggests. Scores of Defense Department employees are laced through the government offices involved in the effort, making up a large portion of the federal personnel devoted to the effort. Those numbers have led some current and former officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to privately grumble that the military's role in Operation Warp Speed was too large for a task force, for a task was beginning again. Let me read the whole paragraph here again. Scores of Defense Department employees are laced through the government offices involved in the effort, making up a large portion of the federal personnel devoted to the effort. Those numbers have led some current and former officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to privately grumble that the military's role in Operation Warp Speed was too large for a task that is at its core a public health campaign. Frankly, it has been breathtaking to watch, unquote, said Paul Ostrowski, O-S-T-R-O-W-S-K-I, the Director of Supply, Production, and Distribution for Operation Warp Speed. Ostrowski is a retired Army Lieutenant General who was selected to manage logistics for the program by General Gustav F. Perna, the Chief Operating Officer for Operation Warp Speed. Again, note the pervasive and enormous role of the military in what is essentially a public health campaign. Wrangling volunteers for four expedited vaccine trials, a chore in any circumstance, became even more challenging during a pandemic when asking hundreds of thousands of subjects to sit in hospital waiting rooms and other healthcare centers was often not feasible. The Pentagon has helped three companies, AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Janssen, to set up pop-up sites to conduct trials at 63 locations nationwide. Of course, the spreading of the pandemic is facilitating that. Whether that is, in part at least, the result of vectoring is anybody's guess. I suspect that that is the case. Continuing with the article, these are the types of things that the military can quickly obtain through its contracting system, as well as any permits needed to set it all up. Quote, we have the ability to set up large-scale housing capabilities throughout the entire world at a moment's notice, unquote, General Ostrowski said. And note the following. Military officials also came up with the clever idea, if it works, to coordinate the delivery of vaccines to drugstores, medical centers, and other immunization sites by sending kits full of needles, syringes, and alcohol wipes. Vaccine makers will be alerted when the kits arrive at the immunization site so they know to ship doses. Now, note this. Once the first dose is given, the manufacturer will be notified so it can send the second dose with a patient's name attached to it several weeks later. The military will also monitor vaccine distribution through an operations center. Quote, they will know where every vaccine dose is, unquote, Paul Mango said on a call with reporters. Mango, by the way, is the deputy chief of staff for policy at the Department of Health and Human Services and the main spokesman for Operation Warp Speed. Note the following again. Military officials also came up with a clever idea, if it works, to coordinate the delivery of vaccines to drugstores, medical centers, and other immunization sites by sending kits full of needles, syringes, and alcohol wipes. Vaccine makers will be alerted when the kits arrive at an immunization site so they know to ship doses. Once the first dose is given, the manufacturer will be notified so it can send the second dose with a patient's name attached to it several weeks later. The military will also monitor vaccine distribution through an operations center. They will know where every vaccine dose is, unquote, Paul Mango said. Well, that doesn't look like there's going to be very much privacy at all. Indeed, the principle of the sanctity of patient-physician communications appears to be, well, basically out the old window in connection with this. Basically, the given the ability of the National Security Establishment to process data. Basically, there will be no privacy in this, and the central role of the military in Operation Warp Speed, with retired General Ostrowski basically in charge, having been put in charge of a lot of the logistics by General Perna, with Moncef Slaoui from the DARPA Finance Moderna Company in charge of the civilian aspects of Operation Warp Speed. This doesn't look very appetizing to me. Again, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but given all of the other corners that have been cut in the Trump administration, and even before Trump, the crony capitalism that is certainly a feature of the Trump administration, and in that regard, just an acceleration of a trend we have seen for decades, this doesn't make me feel very good. You scratch my back, I'll scratch your you-know-what ethic that is prevailing here is not good at all. One of the things that I think we need to be alert for or alerted to is the development with regard to COVID-19 and with regard to pandemics in general of the synthesis, the unification of big pharma, the military and national security establishment's biological warfare program, with the treatment and regulatory bodies involved with treating the diseases that are developed thereby. In For the Record programs 1135, 1136, and 1137, we took a look at Lyme disease and a very important recent book, Bitten, The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons by Chris Newby. And Chris Newby came across the incestuous relationship between Big Pharma, the regulatory and treatment bodies involved with administering help to Lyme disease sufferers, and the biological warfare establishment. In Bitten, and we're reviewing some of the information from 1136, the Lyme documentary Under Our Skin was involved with, Chris Newby was involved with that. It was the first major new disease discovered after the Bayh-Dole Act, and Diamond versus Chakrabarty Supreme Court decision made it possible for the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, and universities to patent and profit from, quote, ownership, unquote, of live organisms. All of a sudden, the institutions that were supposed to be protectors of public health became business partners with Big Pharma. The university researchers who had previously shared information on dangerous emerging diseases were now delaying their findings so they could become entrepreneurs and profit from patents through their university technology transfer groups. we essentially lost our system of scientific checks and balances. And this, in turn, has undermined patient trust in the institutions that are supposed to, quote, do no harm, unquote. It is the patentable vaccines and mandatory tests before treatment that bring in the steady revenues year after year. Just look at what's happening with Big Pharma and testing and vaccines and drug approval, yea verily, as we speak. And still more from Britain. In the IDSA, the Infectious Diseases Society of America guidelines, chronic Lyme disease is not classified as an ongoing persistent infection. It's considered either an autoimmune syndrome in which a body's immune system attacks itself, or a psychological condition caused, quote, by the aches and pains of daily living, unquote, or, quote, prior traumatic psychological events, unquote. These guidelines were often used by medical insurers to deny treatment, and many of its authors are paid consulting fees to testify as expert witnesses in these insurance cases. In some states, the guideline recommendations take on the force of law so that Lyme physicians who practice outside them are at risk of losing their medical licenses. And Attorney General Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, in the supplement press release, Blumenthal had written, quote, my office uncovered undisclosed financial interests held by several of the most powerful IDSA panelists. The IDSA's guideline panel improperly ignored or minimized consideration of alternative medical opinion and evidence regarding chronic Lyme disease, potentially raising more serious questions about whether the recommendations reflected all relevant science. Skipping down. This newly filed the Freedom of Information Act suit. For 5 years, the CDC strung me along with frivolous denials, unexplained delays, and false promises. In essence, the delays became an illegal, off-the-books Freedom of Information Act denial. Some delays were attributed to understaffing, year-end deadlines, and CDC personnel out for vacation. At one point, my unanswered calls were blamed on a phone dead zone, unquote, in the CDC's new FOIA office. Finally, she got her information. The emails revealed a disturbing picture of a non-official group of government employees and guideline authors that had been setting the national Lyme disease research agenda without public oversight or transparency. Investigative journalist Mary Beth Pfeiffer of the Poughkeepsie Journal was given access to these emails, and on May 20th, 2013, she published an expose on this group's abuse of power. Bottom line, the guidelines authors regularly convened in government-funded closed-door meetings with hidden agendas that lined the pockets of academic researchers with significant commercial interests in Lyme disease tests and vaccines. A large percentage of government grants were awarded to the guideline authors and or researchers in their labs. Part of the group's stated mission culled from these FOIA mails was to run a covert disinformation war and a socio-political offensive, unquote, to discredit Lyme patients, physicians, and journalists who questioned the group's research and motives. In the FOIA-obtained emails, Lyme patients and their treating physicians were called loonies and quacks by Lyme guidelines authors and NIH employees. Lyme disease diagnosis and treatment guidelines held direct or indirect, actually I should say, I found that a majority of the authors of the 2006 IDSA Lyme diagnosis and treatment guidelines held direct or indirect commercial interests related to Lyme disease. By defining the disease and endorsing tests or vaccines for which they were patent holders, they and their institutions made more money. We'll review this again, I think, at the beginning of our next show. However, we are now all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1166, BioPsy Apocalypse Now, Part 22. A Pound of Cure, Part 1. This is being recorded on November 28th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.